More of Lake Effect Now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. There are a lot of human inventions like philosophy and religion that attempt to answer the big questions. Why are we here? Do we have a purpose? Why are we so unhappy so much of the time? Do we have the capacity to change? And what does it mean to be a Boston Red Sox fan when they actually win the World Series? Writer Joshua Ferris manages to take on all of these questions in his new novel, To Rise Again at a Decent Hour. His protagonist, Paul, agonizes over all of these existential issues as he cares for the mouths of his Park Avenue dentistry patients. Ferris was in Milwaukee recently. He spoke with Bonnie North, but first shared an excerpt from the book.
My favorite children's book is called Dr. DeSoto by William Stieg. Dr. DeSoto is a mouse dentist who will fix the mouth of any animal who doesn't eat mice. It says so right on the sign hanging outside his shop. Cats and other dangerous animals not accepted for treatment. It's a reasonable policy. It has led me to wonder if I've ever done any work on the mouth of a murderer. One day, a fox shows up outside Dr. DeSoto's office, weeping with pain. Hippocratically bound and inherently kind, Dr. DeSoto is predisposed to help the fox, and his wife, who works as his assistant, encourages him to take pity on the poor beast. So Dr. DeSoto, the brave hero dentist, climbs into the fox's mouth and finds a rotten bicuspid and unusually bad breath. This is how you know that Stieg wasn't a dentist. It's all unusually bad. The fox is grateful to Dr. DeSoto. Yet even knowing that his redeemer is in his mouth at that very moment, working to remedy the pain, the fox itches to eat that tasty little morsel. Dr. DeSoto puts the fox under to extract the tooth, and the fox, laying bare his irrepressible nature, drunkenly mutters how he best likes his mice prepared. That night, Dr. DeSoto has his misgivings about the next day's follow-up. A fox is a fox is a fox. However, he must go through with it. Once he starts a job, he always finishes it. His father, he says, was the same way. My father, too. He'd start to redo the bathroom grout, or lay new linoleum in the kitchen with any other man's new project gusto, and when it was exactly one-third complete, he'd leave, drive some distance, sell the car for a low figure, and walk home and hand the money to my mother, weeping. I won't spoil the ending for you, but needless to say, a fox is a fox is a fox. The foremost heroism on display in Dr. DeSoto isn't the mouse's noble determination to help despite the mortal dangers all around, but the touching suggestion, briefly entertained, that the fox might have an innate capacity to change. When I was filling a cavity, or doing a root canal, or extracting a tooth that was beyond repair, I'd think, this could have been prevented. I'd fall back on my old cynical view of human nature. They don't brush, they don't floss, they don't care. A fox is a fox is a fox. But when they did brush and floss, and still lost a tooth, I had to blame something else. And just as predictably, I'd point the finger at cruel nature or an indifferent God. I was always saying bad oral health was entirely in their control, unless I was saying that it was entirely out of their control. Then one day, I had a patient come in, lived around the corner in one of the few remaining low-income housing complexes on the Upper East Side, worked construction, his hands the hands of a blind strangler, no effort beforehand to remove the chewing tobacco encreviced between his teeth. And while I was at work on a little local train wreck in the upper left quadrant, I let my mind wander. This guy probably had poor genes, ignorant parents, a mean childhood. He was never going to take care of his teeth. He never stood a chance of taking care of them. He was going to neglect them until they fell out or he died. Unless by some miracle, he got up from the chair and changed his life. Unless some store of character revealed itself, and with a little guidance from me, he returned in 6 months a new man. But even then, I thought, that change, that character, would have to be in him already. I was never going to manufacture it with a few stern warnings. God knows I'd tried. And pain forgets within the hour what it learns in an instant. The man in the chair was lord over his best impulses no more than he was king of his worst instincts. Change or no change, his fate was out of his hands. The only question that ever remained was, are you a fox or something better?
Joshua Ferris, welcome to Lake Effect. That was lovely.
Thanks, Bonnie. Thanks for having me.
To Rise Again at a Decent Hour, your latest book, which we just heard that wonderful excerpt from, I almost don't know where to start because there are so many things going on here. But I guess that sort of existential angst moves through the entire thing. And Paul, your protagonist, is trying to figure out who he is and if he has the capacity to change.
Yeah, essentially. He's so at odds with the world. He's very unhappy in many respects. He's a well-paid dentist, so he has a job to go to. He has a nice apartment in Brooklyn. He should, by all measures, be a content man, but he's not. And I think that that really goes to the heart of existence. Why is he here? Why do people suffer? How should he spend his time? What kind of meaningful connections will he make with other people while he's here? All of these questions just aggrieve him, and he's trying to find the answer. And it's really not until he discovers he may belong to a little-known religion that he's willing to consider some other alternatives.
It's not only that they aggrieve him, it's that he can't not stop thinking about them. he is possessed by this. I mean, a lot of people think about this stuff, but it doesn't completely shape their days.
Yeah, he's his worst enemy for sure. And I think in part that's because as a dentist, he has people continually coming into the office who are beset by mortal problems. One guy's got cancer. One guy won't floss. The other guy has a cavity that he won't take care of. So these people continually keep him on notice that the march of time is working always. And then there's the fact that he's just sort of ignored, neglected. I think he describes himself at one point as, at best, a colossal inconvenience for people. So he can't really relax his mind from these thoughts.
So why a dentist, looking at that mortal coil unraveling as opposed to, say, a doctor?
Well, because they're so ignored, you know? They have a rich store of wisdom to impart to each patient, but the patient comes in, gets done, and just flees, you know? And I know this as well just by virtue of being a patient, you know? Flossing's no fun. You don't want to have to do it every day. You don't want to have to go in and get your cavity filled or take care of a root canal. So I think this aggrievement that I think defines him has so much to do with the way in which a dentist isn't respected as well as a doctor is. So I think I would have taken that edge off him if I had made him a neurologist or something.
And also, I think dentists are feared in a way that maybe your average GP isn't.
Yeah. Well, you know, when you go in to a doctor, you may be really sick, but they're not going to take a really small metal thing out and start poking you with it, you know, in the most delicate places. I mean, it's just, you know, between the gum and the tooth, you just don't want a metal piece there. And boy, they just know how to do it.
Yeah, there's something about that, I think, that also feeds in. It's like his choice of profession has made sure that he has that distance. Even though he wants the connection with other people so badly, he's almost set himself up to make sure that that distance remains because of the very profession that he has.
Yeah. Well, he's got to create that or he's going to go crazy. He's going to basically kidnap some people and just floss them for the rest of their lives.
Yeah, going postal or going dental.
Going dental.
The other part of this, or one of the other parts of this, is that little known religion that he finds out that he's a part of, that he resists, but ends up helping him figure out in some ways who he is.
Yeah, he's such an avowed atheist, this guy. And it seems to me that can become its own dogma. And I think that for the bulk of his life, he describes himself as being so resolute in that opinion. And yet the world is not offering him the kind of solace that he might find being a part of a community that all of a sudden presents itself as a possibility. Does he or does he not belong to this heavily persecuted and little-known religion? And not only does he belong or not belong, does it exist? What makes a religion exist? What differentiates a religion from a cult? These questions start to swirl around him and get him thinking in different directions that I think ultimately does reveal that he's something more than a fox.
It also ties in to
his resistance to the modern world of technology as well, because that all feeds into it, because this all begins with a webpage that purports to be by him but isn't.
Right. He sort of comes out of the office, comes out of one of the workstations to discover that there's been a website created in his name on behalf of the dental practice, and nobody has made it in the office. So this really sets him off, and it sets the book in motion in terms of he's got to find out who's done this to him and why. And in the course of that exploration, you also come to learn that he really just wants to belong in ways that he's never really allowed himself or that he doesn't feel legitimate. He wants to belong at first to a family of Catholics, and then he wants to belong to a family of Jews. And he doesn't feel, because he hasn't been born into these traditions, that he belongs there. So when the possibility that he may belong to the Catholics of the Catholics and the Jews of the Jews, he's very intrigued.
Well, he also belongs to another interesting community, and that is of the Red Sox fan.
That's right.
And that permeates the book as well. And having grown up in that Red Sox culture myself, I recognized it instantly. And that shifted for him in 2004 when they won the World Series after 86 years.
Yeah. He has an identity crisis.
He sure does. Yeah. It's a big one.
Well, I wondered if it was a very prevalent condition in Red Sox Nation. You know, I mean, for so many years, the passion and the heartbreak defined the Red Sox in ways that, say, with the Cubs, it didn't, because the Cubs were just sort of expected to lose. The Red Sox were truly expected to win. And in the 86 years that they did not, came very close to doing so. So when they did finally win and won in such a spectacular fashion, I wondered if about a year later, there were some avid fans who wondered, well, who are we now? What makes us unique in the world of baseball? And will we just come to replicate our most reviled enemy?
And we know who that is. Well, maybe listeners here don't know who that is, but of course it's the New York Yankees. I loved the juxtaposition of baseball with this and the Red Sox with this small, you know, as you say, the Jew of the Jew, the Catholic of the Catholic religion, if it exists at all, you know, and somehow needing to find yourself part of something that matters, that other, you know, that you can hang your hat on and say, well, this defines me.
Yeah.
And this is who I am.
You know, I'm just a white guy. I'm some white dude who was sort of had like promiscuous Christianity over the course of his life. I went to different denominations and we would just sort of drift in and out of different churches. And so I never really felt like I had a core identity. And when I was going to school, when I went to college, you know, multiculturalism was very much on everyone's minds. And so the little subcultures that I looked into as an outsider were far richer than my experiences, both at home and sort of within the larger community. So the kind of the historic irony for me is that I could be accepted anywhere. You know, nobody would turn me away for this or that because I was the white dude. But even though I had access to everywhere, I didn't really belong anywhere. And so when I looked into tight-knit religious groups, in particular a friend of mine who I roomed with at Iowa, I went to the University of Iowa, and my roomie there was a Jewish guy from the northwest suburbs of Chicago. And I just got inaugurated into Judaism in a way that was really interesting to me. And I sort of longed for those kind of traditions and the rituals and the community that it provided. And so I, you know, that's sort of Paul's perspective. The dentist's perspective is to look from the outside in and see all that he's missing. And he really, really wants some of it.
But at the same time, he wants it, but he rejects it. He doesn't want to be defined by someone else.
Right.
He wants to define himself.
Right. And here's the rub, I think, in particular with respect to God, because he can't believe. He's too rational. He's too sort of fixed on the reasoned debate and can't allow himself to think of the possibility. And that really does restrict one's participation in a community that centers itself around God. So I think he's trying to figure out how he might participate, and they kind of fail him. But this particular religion embraces skepticism. And so not only does it dovetail nicely with his need for community, but it also seems to have some theological underpinnings that he might get on board with.
Yes, and his adventures into it are really quite that. They're quite interesting, and he travels to Israel, which is where – would you say the headquarters are? Is there a headquarters?
Yeah, it's kind of like a headquarters. A kind of discreet headquarters.
Right.
Out in the desert.
Yeah.
With some goats hanging around.
Exactly. We have to have goats.
It's a low-rent headquarters.
Do you think he finds himself? Do you think he finds that belonging?
I think that the more interesting question might be, does he allow himself the possibility of it? When it's foreclosed to you for so long because of a principle or a strong opinion, just getting to the point where you ask yourself if that is all that helpful to you in your life is a big change. And I think he does. I think he asks himself eventually, do I really want to live shrouded in my skepticism, or do I want to allow for the possibility of something that might surprise me? And he gets surprised.
So he does open himself up to the possibility, but he also hangs on to some of himself from before too.
Yeah, well, let's not kid ourselves. Yeah. When people change, they still retain a whole heck of a lot of their old baggage. So, you know, I think it would have been dishonest of me to, you know, present in the closing pages of the book an entirely new person, somebody that wasn't aggrieved by the challenges of being alive. So he retains enough to be irascibly lovable, but, you know, he's the same guy, but he's thinking about other ways to live. And I think that that does dawn on us from time to time. I'm kind of a skeptic about the amount to which we can change, you know, to the amount to which we can really get outside of ourselves and live an entirely new way. And so I think I try to do as good a job as possible, as good a to allow him to change as much as I think it's humanly possible to change, and see what kind of contentedness might fall over him in the closing bits of the book.
Well, Joshua, it has been such a pleasure, and thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you, Bonnie.
Joshua Ferris's latest novel is called To Rise Again at a Decent Hour. It's just out in hardcover. He spoke with Bonnie North when he was here for a reading at Boswell Book Company. One last break, and then a Lake Effect essayist looks back on a source of school-aged angst, one that might not have been the same issue for you. This is Lake Effect from WUWM.